Hi, welcome to One Foot in the Closet. I'm your host, Name Redacted, and I'm a queer polygender African who lives life with one foot in the closet for reasons of safety, only out to trusted friends and family, but never publicly out in the Western sense, because to do so would be unsafe, as in the country I currently live in, it is illegal to be queer and anything but cisgender. In this podcast, I will interview queer Africans, both on the continent and in the diaspora, who live like I do, with one foot in the closet. Each guest has chosen their own pseudonym, as we are trying to create as safe and engaging a space as possible. I believe conversations like this are not only important, but necessary, to help provide a counter-narrative to the predominant Western narrative of coming out. You don't have to have a bold public declaration to come out. You can exist with one foot in the closet for safety, like I do, and that's perfectly valid and deserves more representation. I would like to unpack the privilege of coming out through this podcast and how not everyone has access to this privilege. This podcast aims to give a platform to queer Africans to tell their own stories in their own words, in a way that is safe to them. Today, we are joined by Queer African Reads. Welcome to One Foot in the Closet, Queer African Reads. Thank you so much for joining us and for agreeing to share a part of your story with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
You're more than welcome. I really appreciate you for coming on. We have interacted in the past via my actual name, which shall not be revealed on this podcast. But we've been interacting for the past couple of years. And so it's my honor to have you here. And it's a real blessing to have you be able to be on this podcast and to be able to share your story. You were one of the first people who came to mind when I came up with this podcast idea. So I'm really grateful that
Amazing.
You were willing and able to join us.
Thank you so much. And thank you for thinking of me. And it's always such a pleasure working with you. We've done many little projects that we cannot discuss. But it's always been great.
We have. And it's always been a pleasure. Thank you so much. And it's a pleasure being on the other side of things, because usually you're the one doing the...
Right. I'm the one who's always like, so we're going to do this thing with you, and we're going to do this thing with
exactly,
you.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And for me, it's honestly a breath of fresh air being on the other side of things, because I'm so used to being the one being interviewed. And so being the one doing the interviews instead, right, it's a refreshing change of pace.
I mean, now that you say it, I think this is my very first interview, actually, now that you mentioned it.
Oh, that's amazing. Congratulations.
Thanks.
I'm honored. Thank you so much for letting me be your first interview.
Yeah, sure.
All right. So my first question for you is, can you recall your first memory of encountering queerness?
Encountering queerness. I think growing up and being exposed to Western media, there was always, I think we grew up in a very interesting time. Like those of us who were born in the late 80s and early 90s, because men were a lot more effeminate on TV. Mm-hmm. And their shirts were open really low and their pants were tight and they really took care of themselves. I remember when we went from like more mainstream gender neutral attire to it being a thing to be called a metrosexual. I remember when David Beckham was like the first metrosexual. So what I'm saying is, like, I cannot think of my first experience of queerness because it was all around me. I grew up watching Prince and what's his name? Iman's David Bowie, and I was watching like 80s music and the Isley Brothers, and they were all looking so fly and looking so good. And then you got to this sort of weird point of hyper masculinity where if a man brushes his teeth, he's metrosexual, you know? I was like, what is happening? And I remember it was a whole thing, like even in my neighborhood, there were men who would go for manicures and it was such a big deal. Like this man gets his feet scrubbed and gets his nails trimmed professionally, and that's metrosexuality. So I think what I witnessed was like an anti-queerness happening where all these things were totally normal, or at most you were just an oddball. And then we had this like strong cis heterosexual male ideal, and that anybody who wasn't part of that was being labeled. But also the weird thing about metrosexuality is that there's an undercurrent of I'm still a straight man. You know? Mm-hmm. It's just that I like conditioner in my hair, but I'm still a straight cishet man. Yeah. So I think that's when I started getting like messaging about like, what is the straight and narrow and what isn't. And it was in this weird way that it was reinforcing cis heterosexuality.
Yeah, my older brother was labeled, my oldest brother was labeled metrosexual when I was younger because he liked taking care of himself. Okay. Because he liked, you know, grooming himself properly. He liked putting himself together in a way, clothing-wise, that, like, fit for his body. And he, you know, liked taking care of his skin and his hair and all of these things. But that metrosexual label was also attached with, like, a label of being soft and feminine. And like, yeah, those were, yeah, negative things, you know, even though they aren't.
Yeah, exactly.
And I saw him grow up with that. And it was strange for me to see, because I never really understood the label of metrosexual, because first of all, it's not a sexuality, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like why sexual? Yeah. What do you mean sexual?
Exactly. And it was just like, a man who takes care of themselves, like, shouldn't every man do that? Like,
yeah,
I never understood it either. But you're right in that those of us who were born in the late 80s, early 90s, grew up with a lot of examples of that on TV and a lot of...
Yeah, like men were wearing makeup all the time and it wasn't something to even blink twice at.
Mm-hmm.
Or gelling their hair excessively. It was like, that's what men do, you know?
Exactly, exactly. Whereas with now, you've had the complete, you know, backlash to that through, like...
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now there's like a never-ending laundry list of what men cannot do, and it's growing all the time. When you go on Twitter, Twitter is like an anthropological study of like the evolution of cis heterosexuality for men, because it's like the latest ones are like, as a man, you shouldn't laugh for longer than 2 seconds at your friend's joke.
Oh,
how did we get here? Like, mirth is now feminine, you know. Mm-hmm. We came from like men shouldn't drink cocktails, like men shouldn't even laugh.
Oh my goodness.
So weird.
I mean, I guess it's a good thing I'm polygender then, because I definitely laughed for longer than 2 seconds at that.
Exactly. Like whenever I see like I'm a woman, I'm like, thank God that's not me. Like as a woman, you should do this. I'm like, that's too bad, because I'm not a woman.
And did you notice all those trends of like all those like grooming products that are marketed to men, like shampoo for men? It's like,
yeah, like, and, you know, 15 in one.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the 15 in one, which like is its own thing, which like I never really understood how something can contain that many different ingredients and still work for all those different things. Yeah. but there's also
I think I know what you mean, like gunpowder.
Exactly,
scented, you know?
Exactly, exactly. All these stereotypically masculine, strong, you're not soft for like using this,
yeah,
which is its own bag of...
And I wonder if like cishet men think about, like if I was a man and I'm like, I don't know, like a pacifist and you're selling me gunpowder scented things, like why do you think that as a man that I should love guns? Like, do men care about, do they look at these labels? Because it's not like I look at labels on like feminine stuff and I'm like, yeah, I want to wear, I don't know, sunflower daiquiri. Like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if men actually care or look at these things and they're like, this is so weird. Like, what do you mean? This smells like steel. Like, I don't want to smell like steel. Just because I'm a man. I don't know.
I have no idea. But we can send that question out to our audience if anybody listening has any answers to that question. If we have any cishet men listening who think about the things that they purchase and whether or not they actually want to smell like steel, please let us know.
Yeah, let us know.
All right. So my second question for you is, can you recall your first memory of encountering queerness within your own self?
Yeah, for me it was, so from the ages of, I don't know, when did I start school? Like from the ages of 3 to 12, I always went to like mixed sex schools. And I remember like from like the very first years of school, like, oh, I still get offended to this day. I think I'm still upset about it, because there's this guy in my class called Charles and he and I were friends, and automatically becomes, oh, Charles is your boyfriend, Charles is your boyfriend. And I used to get so pissed off because I didn't, number one, I didn't want to have a boyfriend. And number two, like, God, why is everyone extrapolating, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the case all throughout, like, until I was 12, right? Boys always, like, telling you that they like you. And there's always, like, whispers in the classroom about, like, oh, this boy likes this girl and this girl likes this boy. And it was so annoying to me. And then I ended up going to an all-girls school. And I think everything came, like, into sharp focus because this was the first time that I was in class with someone and I was actually attracted to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting my... People used to, like, I see why y'all were always whispering, like, this is exciting. Oh, the butterflies. But it was a Catholic school,
mm-hmm.
and I grew up Catholic. Mm-hmm. So that was also, it was very confusing. And I was like, maybe this is, I convinced myself that I was just going through a phase.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't. But, you know, yeah, that was my first experience. Like, the whole time that I was in mixed schools, I never felt anything like that. And then I went into an all-girls school and I was like, I see. This is what you people mean when you say that you have a crush on someone.
Mm-hmm.
I see. I get it. Yeah.
And in that all-girls school, were there other people who you knew were queer as well, who you could talk to about these issues? Or
no, like I said, it was a Catholic mm-hmm. school. Just even, it wasn't even about being queer, like even heterosexual activity was frowned upon. So how much worse would it be to discuss queerness? Like, what am I saying? It wasn't even just that heterosexual activity was frowned upon. It was even, like, I remember we used to get talks about how when you're in the shower, you shouldn't take too long in the shower. And when you get out of the shower and it's time to lotion yourself, make sure that you cover your body with a towel and, like, you expose each body part that you need to lotion. And then you lotion it and you hide it away again. Like, don't look at yourself. Don't spend too much time with yourself. It was a very sexually repressed place. But also, I remember, because I stayed there for 6 years, I remember that, like, towards the end, there was, you know how, like, the extreme end of anti-queerness is always, like, inflammatory accusations of lesbianism,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's either nothing is happening, like, the school is rampant with lesbians, like, so two girls hanging together, oh, lesbians, you know. So it was always, like, one extreme or the other. But I only encountered that other extreme of, like, accusations of lesbianism, like, towards the end of school. So there was never that chance to, and also, like, as a teenager, you think that everyone's straight,
mm-hmm.
like, you're the odd one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everyone's obviously straight and you're just weird. So it's not like you can seek solace in anyone.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever personally encounter those accusations of lesbianism, or was it more general?
No.
School? Okay.
No, it was like some other, like, quote unquote bad girls.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Those girls are so bad. Like, they're even lesbians. That's how bad they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What you shared about when you're in primary school with being close to that boy that you mentioned who was your friend and people constantly labeling it as a relationship, that...
It wasn't even primary school. That was kindergarten.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's way too early. But, like,
yeah.
I mean, the ways people, like, automatically label these things on children who, like, haven't even hit puberty yet. Because I didn't develop, like, romantic or sexual feelings until puberty, you know? Like, before that, like, it was, like, all just, like, platonic.
Exactly.
And the ways people, like, label things on children especially is terrible. I remember I went through a similar experience because I was fat in my youth. And there was mm-hmm. another... I mean, fat is one of those words that people have, you know, tried to, like, reclaim.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it.
But I still have a problem with it because I was, like, called fat, like, so much.
Ooh, right.
As, like, you know, an insult that, like, it still makes me uncomfortable. So I'm going to shift to plus size because
even
just saying it out loud just makes me uncomfortable because it was used so much throughout my youth as a way of, like...
In a derogatory fashion.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like one of those, like, you know, those older queer people who, like, feel uncomfortable with the word queer.
Yeah.
So I'm like that with the word fat.
Right.
And so there was this other plus size girl in the school, and everybody would always be like,
name redacted.
And this person are now boyfriend and girlfriend because they're the two plus size people in the school, you know? Which, like, I'm more than my body size. So do you think that, like, nobody can be attracted to me because of my size apart from somebody
except
else?
Someone
who's, yeah,
like
exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Children can be terrible.
Kids are evil.
Mm-hmm.
But so are adults, anyway.
And you mentioned the Catholic school that you went to, and you mentioned being raised Catholic. I was raised Catholic as well. And one thing that I've struggled with is Catholic guilt.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I don't. Like, I do not struggle with Catholic guilt. Let me not say that I hear you. I mean, I know about the experience of Catholic guilt. I do not struggle with it at all. But also, I could be saying that, but maybe what I do struggle with, I don't see as Catholic guilt, but maybe it's a product of Catholic guilt. Because I am very proud of myself to, like, do the right thing always. For me, what's different is that certain things that the Catholic Church deems wrong, I don't. Mm-hmm. So then I don't end up having that Catholic guilt. But like I'm saying, it could extend into other aspects of my life. Like when I do think that something is wrong, I really have a hard time forgiving myself when I make a mistake. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the aspect of Catholic guilt that I inherited.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That makes sense completely. All right. So we've been emailing back and forth, and you had some discussion topics that you said that you would like to get into. And so, I'd love to get into those now. And so one of the things that you wanted to talk about was identity politics. And so my question for you is, what have been your experiences with identity politics, especially in regards to queerness?
I mean, now that I think back on it, I'm not sure why I wanted to discuss identity politics. But if I think about it, there's a running conversation that I'm always having with my other queer friends. So I run Queer Africa Reads, the book reviewing page. And I feel like I'm going to expose myself when I discuss this particular thing. But basically, I hope there's no trolls that end up coming my way. Basically, something that I've noticed and something that my friends have noticed as well, is sometimes when you read queer authors, queer Black authors, and certain authors that I've read, they write from a place of like moral superiority because of their intersections, right? So you would never understand because you're not Black. You would never understand because you're not queer. You would never understand because you're not disabled, right? So I'm on the right side of history and on the right side of knowledge because I am all these things. Mm-hmm. And then when these authors are criticized, the backlash, like the way that they react, it's like, how dare you say this to me as a queer, disabled Black person? Like, you could never understand. But like other queer Black disabled people are looking at it like, this is actually wrong, you know, like blatantly wrong. And let me not even talk about like queer Black disability, but even in the book space, I mean, I don't know if I'm talking to like active readers who also spend all their time on Twitter, but there's always so many scandals like involving writers who are women, mm-hmm. or who are queer women, mm-hmm. Or who are queer. Like there's a trans man called, this one I can call out, called Anna Mardle, who recently had a full scandal, and they've spent their whole Twitter career calling out people for being transphobic in their books, right? Like finding books and saying this book is transphobic because of XYZ. And I'm saying this because I'm a trans man and I know it. They're absolutely correct, right?
Could you say the person's name again? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Anna Mardle, A-N-A is their first name, and then M-A-R-D-O-L-L. Okay. Yeah, so he recently, unfortunately, to some very like right-wing media, it was discovered that he works for like the biggest weapons manufacturer in the world.
Oh my God.
And yeah, so he's a nepo baby. So he has like a parent who works at the company. And so he ended up getting the job. But all through his Twitter like lifespan, he was asking people for money. Like, I'm a disabled trans person and I need money, you know? And then people find out about his job and they're like, you're making so much money, number one. Number two, you're literally participating in the decimation of Black and brown babies all over the world, mm-hmm. you know? And then there's this whole back and forth conversation with a lot of people. It became so funny because a lot of people are coming forward like, I too work for this weapons manufacturer company. And I think it's perfectly fine. Like, I'm queer and I'm disabled. I'm allowed to do this so that I can survive. And it's like, don't you think that there are queer disabled people in the third world who deserve to live? Like, why is your life more important? And why do these intersections allow you to commit crimes against humanity, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're at a place where identity is weaponized so much in such a weird way. And I recognize that, like, the history of identity politics wasn't that. Like, when the Kumbahi Weaver Collective were talking about identity politics, this is not the future that they envision. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it worries me when I see the weaponization of identity. And sometimes, I don't know, like, I don't want to sound like a right-wing person, because I was like, identity politics, you know, mm-hmm. these things are important. Mm-hmm. These things are important. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, the same thing you're saying, like, children are evil, adults are evil. Like, people will always find a really nefarious way to take an important thing and a good thing and turn it into a bad one. You know what I mean? I don't know what you think about that.
I mean, what I think is, I mean, I'm a queer disabled polygender person.
Black.
Yeah, black person, yeah. And yeah. Like, one thing that I find is similar to what you said is a lot of people engage in like oppression Olympics, where it's like, I'm more oppressed than you are because like, I'm queer, disabled, black, trans, I'm poor, and I'm, you know, from the global south, and like, you know, and it's like, it's not a competition, you know, like, like nobody wants to be oppressed. Nobody wants to be marginalized. Like the whole goal of identity politics and intersectionality, from what I understood it, was just like to have like a better understanding of where different people are coming from and the like, you know, like intersections of oppression and how like, say, a white woman can be oppressed, but in different ways than a black woman.
Yeah, but I find it so interesting that you just said that nobody wants to be oppressed, because I'm wondering if that's true. And I think I've even thought about that about myself, like when I'm moving through the world, because like I'm a Cancer, and let's go into astrology now. I'm a Cancer, and Cancers, like we're not very good at accountability, and we always want something else to be the reason why something has happened, you know. We're not very good at holding ourselves responsible for our actions. So I think about that so much. And even when I read Bell Hooks, that she says that you need to move from victimhood to self-actualization and getting out of that place of like, woe is me, I'm all these things, therefore I deserve like more sympathy, or I deserve you to cut me some slack. So I don't know if I particularly agree with the idea that nobody wants to be oppressed, because I think for a lot of people, and that's why I was giving you like these prominent examples, like if you take away their blackness, their queerness, their disability, what will they use as their moral high ground or as the thing that they hold on to for people to listen to them, or, you know, to give them a little bit more care, or to hold them less accountable? Do you know what I mean?
You're 100% right. I mean, I think the reason I said nobody wants to be oppressed is because I don't want to be oppressed. But like, you're 100% right, because I've met a lot of people who do actually seek out oppression. They like using the ways that they are oppressed to gain sympathy points, or to gain victimhood, or to gain whatever it is that they're gaining. But there are actually quite a large amount of people who do get something out of oppression, which I've never understood, which is, I think, why I said nobody wants to be oppressed, because, like, I can't relate to that. But you're definitely right that there are a lot of people who do want to be oppressed and who actively seek it out, which was once again something that I can never really understand.
Yeah, and maybe that's the effect of living under capitalism, because you're trying to gain some leverage and any way possible, because in a weird way, as much as oppression is locking you out of so many opportunities, it's also opening up some very interesting doors for you, especially in this post-identity politics era of, you know, living in capitalist society and really taking into account people's identities. So I don't know, like if everybody had like the resources that they needed and was living comfortably and in community, maybe we wouldn't be leaning so much on our various oppressions to get like an inch in. Like if you can't get access to what you need equitably, then you're going to use like your little oppressions to get access to some things, you know?
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, I've definitely used my oppressions to like gain access to like grants and things like that, where it's like, you know, like, if they say in the thing that like they want to prioritize LGBTQIA+, BIPOC, disabled.
Oh, yeah.
If they say that they want to prioritize that, then I'm going to mention all of that in my application.
Exactly.
And it's like one of those things where, for me, I see it as like a evening of the playing field, because like white cis-het people have been dominating and still do dominate these things. And so it's like, if they're trying to like do some form of like an affirmative action, I'm like going to take advantage of that.
Exactly. And the reverse also works, right? Like in a capitalist society, if you're a cis-het white man, well, we also need to take into account class, of course, but if you're a cis-het white man, you don't need to rely on your oppressions, because life comes to you. So like everything comes to you so easily. You're already seen as the person who is entitled to be in the space, you know? So you don't need to lean into, you know, all the intersections of how you're oppressed, because you're fine.
Exactly. But then you also have like one of my friends is always complaining to me about how hard it is being a white man in today's society. Because he said that everything goes to the oppressed people. He said like he's always trying to like apply for things, and they always say that they prioritize LGBTQIA+, they prioritize disabled. And he's disabled, but like they prioritize people of color. And he says that like everything is going to all these oppressed people, and there's nothing left for the white man in the world.
Interesting.
Which I vehemently disagree with, because like the white people are still dominating things, you know, and they're still like
literally
making up the majority of most industries, especially at the top. But for him, he feels oppressed because of the ways that identity politics is now moved to the forefront of the conversation.
I get it.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. And so in relation to identity politics and how people sort of weaponize it in a way to gain favor or to gain whatever it is that they're trying to gain, you also mentioned that you wanted to discuss elite capture. And you sent me a wonderful article, which really explained it thoroughly for my sake. But for the sake of our listeners, could you do a quick definition of what elite capture is? And could you also talk about what your experiences have been with elite capture, especially when it comes to queerness?
I might have to pull out the definitions that I'm as precise as possible. But yeah, so there's this guy on Twitter called Olufemi Taiwo. And
he's a twin.
Do you think so? Like Taiwo and Kehinde. But Taiwo is his surname.
Because
I wouldn't know.
I don't know, because all the Taiwos I've known have been twins.
Right? Taiwos and Taiwos. Anyway, we don't know. Anyway, so he's like good in the leftist space, and he recently came out with a book, and a lot of people have been reading it. The full title is Elite Capture: How the Powerful Took Over Identity Politics and Everything Else, right? And elite capture is basically the idea of, let me just rip off, it's the idea that if we're looking at identity politics, and we're talking about like you could have Black disabled people, and the reason why we focus on our identities, obviously, is because we're trying to move towards liberation, right? The reason why queer women came together in the 1970s, Black queer women came together in the 1970s and spoke about their experiences as Black queer women and as feminists, and tried to, and created the second wave of feminism, wasn't just so they can gather together and cry about their oppressions, it's so that they can push forward feminism, right? Because that was when we had a lot of like white feminist ideology, which was like feminism for white women only. Everybody else can be in the mud. And you have Black queer, poor women, lesbians coming forward and saying, you know, we should be part of the feminist movement, and we believe in feminism as this and this and that. And that's why we have identity politics, right? So when we speak about the idea of elite capture, it's that within these movements of resistance and these movements of like liberation, you will have people coming, again, it's within a capitalist society, you'll have people coming forward, the elites of those identities, and taking over for nefarious reasons. So the example that I was thinking about is that here in Kenya, for instance, you have, we just had the general election that ended a few weeks ago. And prior to that, there was this idea of clearing the ballot. And when I saw it on Twitter, I was very confused, because I was like, what could this possibly mean, queering the ballot? How do we queer the ballot, right? Like, don't queer people already vote? Isn't the ballot inherently anti-queer? I don't know. If you think about democracy and what we want for a democracy, queerness as far as democracy would not be this capitalist society that we live in where you only have like terrible options to choose from and you're doomed either way, where all the leaders that you have are probably coming forward and sticking to the Western script that's like LGBTQ people do not exist in Africa. Like that's an issue, you know? So how are we going to queer the ballot? The ballot which leads to the laws which oppress us, mm-hmm. you know, it's so confusing. But the idea of elite capture here is that NGOs that deal with like LGBTQ persons will come forward and come up with an initiative, you know, as the representatives of queer Africans. And the ideas that they will come up with, like this queering the ballot idea, is not representative, one, of the queer Kenyans on the ground, or two, of their needs, you know. What do queer Kenyans need right now? You know, they need the price of oil to go down, the price of flour to go down. They need access to healthcare. They need access to education. They don't want to be threatened with getting kicked out of boarding schools because they're queer. They don't need to be represented in a polling station because that's literally what it was, you know? So that's what elite capture is. This idea that you have this movement that's building, that people are talking and they're saying queer Africans need this and this and that. And then you have elites coming in and capturing your movement and watering it down and turning it into essentially nonsense, but dominating the scene completely.
Yeah. I mean, that reminds me of the quote from one of my favorite movies of all time. You either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Literally. And it's not just, I mean, I could think of like several other examples of capture because it's not just about queerness. We're speaking about queerness here because this is what the podcast is about. But there's so many different ways. Like even if you see like, I don't know, like Black political resistant movements, and you have the people who are on the ground, right? Like the Black Panthers who are doing the actual work. And then who do you get at the top? A Barack Obama, you know, sort of springs through. And it's like, this is what the Black people have always wanted. Really? The Black people just want another guy to bomb countries? Is that what they really wanted? Like another millionaire? Or were they asking for no guns in their communities or safety and security or good schools or access to clean water? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, completely. And it's unfortunate how, because you see it happen all the time with movements throughout the world where people rise up with, like, I mean, in Uganda's case, I remember reading this newspaper article from the 80s where our president Museveni said that he was only going to stay for one term. And that was like publicly said in the newspaper because he fought the War of Liberation, said he was going to stay for one term and then it was going to transition out. And then he became everything that he said that he wasn't going to be. You know what I mean?
Museveni is so confusing to me because wasn't he like a protege of Julius Nyerere?
Yes.
Like what went wrong? When did the rain start beating us?
But I think that's the thing with power, which is why I'm terrified of ever gaining like a sliver of power. Like I'm perfectly fine doing my things independently and like just doing my things at a low level because like I feel like power corrupts.
Absolutely. And
I feel like everybody who's given that taste of power, they change and they switch up on people completely.
It's so weird to me. And I think about it. I mean, I'm absolutely with you in being afraid of gaining access to power. But for me, it's even more so, I'm afraid of gaining like access to wealth, just like even working hard and making a lot of money. And I was telling my friend this story, not even recently, but this thing really stuck with me. I was watching a Kenyan blogger. I'm really putting people on blast in the podcast. I was watching a Kenyan blogger, and during this episode of her vlog, first she started off by showing us like the new German pots that she had just purchased. And this was like at the height of COVID. So she's like, I just got these fantastic pots. And then like 20 minutes later, she was like, guys, let me show you my new washing machine. It has access to Wi-Fi and like it takes voice command.
And, a washing machine with a Wi-Fi?
And then I was like, why do you need a Wi-Fi connection? Anyway, all this to say, towards the end of the vlog, she's like, so basically why I got that washing machine is because I cannot afford to have two housekeepers anymore, so I'm firing one of them. And she's being replaced by the washing machine.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, oh, Lord.
That's
almighty.
Terrible.
Like, I just, you know, like right now from this place of poverty that I sit in, I'm like, that's horrific. But I always wonder if, like, if I made a lot of money, if I would also be that person who's like, we don't need you anymore. We're just going to buy this ultra fancy, super expensive washing machine because we can't afford to pay your salary anymore. And it's like, that washing machine could have probably paid 10 mm-hmm. of her salary. Oh my God. I don't know.
I'm also completely oblivious to the plight of the poor worker who's now out of a job during COVID.
During COVID. This is what you decided was best for the family. All right. Yeah, so I guess, I was just agreeing with you that, like, power corrupts, but I think even just without power, like, any access to, like, material comforts can also be quite corrupting, and I fear that so much. Like, I don't want to get so comfortable that I no longer humanize the experiences of other people.
Definitely. Like, I wholeheartedly agree with you, because, like, I'm not wealthy in any terms, but have a roof over my head, which I'm grateful for, and I'm trying to get to a point where I'm more financially stable, because right now I'm, like, dependent on family, which is great to have that option, but it's also an option that, like, is dependent on them being alive to support me, which is not always, you know, it's not going to be around forever. And, like, we have a lot of debt that we're trying to pay off, and will hopefully pay off in time. But at the same time, I would like to get to a point where I'm comfortable enough that money does not stress me out, you know? And, like, you're not working as hard as you can.
Right, exactly.
To try to just get to a point where you're more comfortable and you don't have to worry about money every single day.
Yeah. And no longer living hand to mouth. But for me, I think I look at it on the other end where I'm like, okay, but how much would be enough? Like, right now I'm working to get to a point, but what is that point? How much is that point? I mean, where's the threshold over which if I cross, I'll start having like unrealistic ideas of how I should be living, you know? Suddenly I'm like, obviously I deserve to live in a mansion, you know? And obviously I deserve to drive a big V8 engine vehicle, you know? At what point do I start thinking like those are normal aspirations? And I'm sure somebody's probably listening to this like, those are totally normal aspirations. I'm sorry, I'm coming from like a communist lens. So I'm sure there are poor people. I mean, I know for a fact there are very many poor people who aspire to these grand things like private jets and designer clothing. But being someone who doesn't aspire to those things, I always wonder like what the threshold amount would be before I start being completely delusional and thinking that private jets are a necessity, you know?
I definitely think a billion is way past that threshold.
Right. Absolutely.
Because billionaires are just another thing completely. But I'm not sure what that threshold is either. Because it seems like also with money, it seems like the more that you acquire, the more that you want. And the more that you like just want to build.
And your needs change.
Yeah, exactly.
Your needs change so much.
Exactly.
Yeah, like I'm amazed at how I can live. Like when I was a student, I'm amazed at the things that were totally like luxuries or optional that now I'm like, oh, I have to have it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have to have it a few years ago. Why do I have to have it now?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very corrupting, like you said. Anyway. Yeah. Moving on.
I mean, we could talk about this all day. But
yeah.
One thing that you mentioned actually in your earlier answer was you mentioned moving towards liberation. And you mentioned that being an end goal that you could foresee.
Right.
And so that was actually one of the topics that you wanted to get into. You said that you wanted to discuss queer liberation. And so my question to you is, what have your experiences been with queer liberation, and how can you foresee us as a society moving towards queer liberation, but also just liberation in general beyond queerness?
I think it's important to remain hopeful, but like sometimes when I'm going through my day-to-day life, it's hard to be hopeful, right? Because like I said, I'm in the NGO space. I'm working, I think I said that to you before we started recording. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I moved from working in like legal work to working in the NGO space. And a lot of these initiatives that we work on, right, are you work based off of what the donors want you to do, right? Because a lot of the work that we do in the NGO space is not necessarily a product of passion. It's more a product of what is their money available for. So that's why you have so many NGOs dedicated to like sexual and reproductive health rights or sexual and gender-based violence, and little to none focused on things like climate change. Because if you're passionate about climate change, but nobody wants to fund your initiative, you're not going to get very far. So sometimes and this goes back to the whole NGOization of resistance and elite capture. Sometimes I get really disheartened when I think about the fact that a lot of the work that we're doing on the ground isn't dictated by us or isn't, yeah, if I want to move towards liberation, but I'm dependent on external funding and this external funding comes from, it could go either way. It could be coming from organizations that are, I mean, as is the case with Uganda and Nigeria, there are a lot of NGOs that are being funded by like the religious right that are working to stop the LGBT movement from growing in those countries, or even in Ghana right now. That's a huge problem. Or you could be getting funded in the other direction, which is pushing for and advocating for abolition of laws preventing LGBT like legality in your country. But the point of all that is that you are dependent on what your funders and your donors say you should be doing. So that stresses me out so much. But of course, I guess the answer is obviously to pool resources within the grassroots and to work within the grassroots. If we ever want to get liberated, we cannot rely on these Western systems. Of course, we can rely on international solidarity with other people who are doing the work that we are doing. But from where I'm sitting, I think that there needs to be less reliance on Western funding and Western agenda building if we are to actually move towards liberation, because at the same time, there's no way that a Western organization knows what I need here on the ground as a queer person.
Definitely.
But at the same time, I don't see that really happening on a large scale anytime soon. Like NGOs are really taking over, especially like liberal countries like Kenya, which is so open to like Western infiltration. I think what I'm trying to say is like, I want to be optimistic because liberation requires a lot of optimism, but I'm just not at the moment because the work that I see happening every day is just a bit, it arouses pessimism within me.
That makes complete sense. Like, it's hard to be optimistic when everything around you that you're seeing is not optimistic and is very Western agenda, Western funded. You have to do everything that the donor wants because you're dependent on the donor's money to survive for the organization. It's like everything. One option that comes to mind is you could become wealthy and just fund things yourself.
Right. But first, I have to work in the trenches.
Yeah. And then, like, who knows, like, what a wealthy you would look like, you know? Like, maybe you'd get corrupted then again, then you become everything that you were fighting against.
Exactly. Maybe wealthy me will just be like you were saying, I'd like, I'll list all my intersections and be like, well, I made it. Therefore, queer people have made it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Liberation is here.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If I can do it, so can you.
So can you. Which is not the right way to go about.
Definitely not.
This was One Foot in the Closet. If you'd like to support our podcast, please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And please take the time to leave a rating and review, especially on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. We'd love to hear back from you. Wherever you're listening in from, please share your thoughts with us via email at onefootinthecloset@gmail.com. Like our Facebook page, One Foot in the Closet. Follow our Instagram at One Foot in Closet and follow our Twitter at One Foot in Closet. Please send any messages, thoughts, comments, and questions via social media or email. One Foot in the Closet was created by Name Redacted, hosted by Name Redacted, theme music by Annie King Smith, edited by Annie King Smith, mixed and produced by Drew Deacon Thomas. This project was funded by House of African Feminisms, a project of the Goethe Institute, Kigali, Lagos, and Johannesburg.